Hi, folk. Welcome back to the Fearless Flyer, episode 39. My name's Grant. I'm one of your co-hosts, and my other co-host is James.
Hello, everyone. How are you doing today?
Today or this evening, maybe, or it might be the morning to listen to. Who knows? Okay, on to the episode. In this episode, episode 39, we'll start by discussing the regulatory authorities that govern international aviation, and then we'll talk about another authority, well, kind of an authority which is run by big business. We'll have a discussion about the units of measurements used in international aviation, as it's not as straightforward as you think it should be. We'll chat about the NATTRAX, which is the North Atlantic Track System, and finish up on how airports and runways are designed.
Sounds good. Just a quick recap then. In the last episode, episode 38, we discussed media sensationalism, which was an interesting discussion. Well, we went a bit off topic, to be fair, and talked about some accident statistics and go-arounds as well. Yeah. Anyway, back to this episode. Just a little bit of history to start. Civil aviation regulations really only started post-World War II. As aviation progressed so far in such a short few years throughout the Second World War. So the United Nations in 1944 held a convention called the Chicago Convention on International Civil Aviation to set out baseline rules that all nations whom were a part of the UN had to abide by in regards to civil aviation, hence the beginning of the International Civil Aviation Organization, or ICAO for short.
So from the ICAO website, the first few sentences are quite significant in the context of what they do. And we have our special regulator voice to announce their objectives.
The International Civil Aviation Organization, or ICAO for short, is funded and directed by 193 national governments to support their diplomacy and cooperation in air transport as signatory states to the 1944 Chicago Convention. Its core function is to maintain an administrative and expert bureaucracy supporting these diplomatic interactions, to research new air transport policy, and the standardization of innovations as directed and endorsed by governments through the ICAO Assembly or by the ICAO Council, which the Assembly elects.
And then the voice of the regulator goes on to state that
once governments achieve diplomatic consensus around a new standard scope and details, it is then adopted by those same 193 countries in order to bring worldwide alignment to their national regulations, helping to realise safe, secure, and sustainable air operations on a truly global basis.
An important note here, though, is ICAO is not a global regulator.
The stipulations ICAO standards contain never supersede the primacy of national regulatory requirements. It is always the local national regulations which are enforced in and by sovereign states and which must be legally adhered to by air operators making use of applicable airspace and airports. Contrary to many dramatic and media portrayals of UN agencies, they do not have any authority over national governments in the areas of international priority they are established for. Critiques of the UN are often rooted in allegations founded on fantastical capabilities and authorities which sovereign states would never assign to a multilateral organisation. ICAO is therefore not an international aviation regulator, just as Interpol is not an international police force. We cannot arbitrarily close or restrict countries' airspace, shut down routes, or condemn airports or airlines for poor safety performance or customer service.
The ICAO was born in 1944 and is the basis of a lot of the harmonisation of rules and agreements between countries. You might even think they would have tried to harmonise the units of measurement that should be used, but, well, let's see how that panned out.
Yes, so the ICAO 193 member states basically created a shared model of international standards, and these standards provide the basis for a country's national regulations or regulators, such as the Federal Aviation Administration or the FAA in the US, or the Civil Aviation Authority in the United Kingdom.
You might have also heard of another aviation organization, and this is called IATA, which stands for International Aviation Transport Association. IATA was formed in Cuba in 1945 as a trade association of the world's airlines. From their website, it states that this is a trade association for the world's airlines, representing some 300 airlines or 83% of total air traffic. They go on to say, "We support many areas of aviation activity and help formulate industry policy on critical aviation issues."
Yeah, so in essence, a group of businesses that have a vested interest in aviation. Now, IATA has also been described as a cartel since they have supposedly organized tariff conferences that have served as a venue for price fixing. Now, you can be the judge as to whether IATA is a form of a cartel. However, there are countries that limit competition on certain routes or at certain airports, and these countries, or more to the point, their governments supposedly support free competition. You could therefore question why on certain routes these ticket costs are so high, yet on routes between other countries whereby you might be flying, say, twice the distance, the ticket costs are much cheaper. So as I said before, you can be the judge in trying to understand why choice is limited and certain routes have exorbitant ticket prices. You be the judge.
Yeah, and as Grant said, it's never actually been officially proven, so that is just sort of an opinion that floats around there in the media now and again.
Well, yeah, I think the passenger can make that opinion of them for themselves when they're purchasing a ticket on a route that maybe has only one or two airlines operating it.
Moving on, here is something that you'll see every time you go to an airport, but it's from IATA. All our airport codes are on computers and flight planning, are four-letter ICAO codes. However, the codes you generally see that are generally associated with airports and airlines are three-letter IATA codes. A few examples. Auckland's ICAO is NZAA, where the IATA is AKL.
London Heathrow ICAO code is EGLL, whilst its IATA code is LHR, as in London Heathrow.
And generally, one or two of the first letters of the ICAO code is its country code, like London Gatwick would be EGKK. However, the IATA code implies a bit more logic to their name, and that IATA code is for Gatwick is LGW. The US has got all this logic thought through, in that their country ICAO code letter is simply the first one and it's the letter K. Then the following three ICAO letters and the IATA letters are the same. So San Francisco ICAO code is KSFO and the IATA is SFO. Austin's is KBOS and its IATA code is BOS. And this sort of carries on for most American airports.
Yeah, that's right. So we talked about how ICAO is supposed to harmonize civil aviation across the planet. But before we tell you why it's not straightforward, let's look at vehicle traffic and how they measure speeds and distances on those signs on the side of the road. In the US and the UK, the speed shown on your car speedo thing is in miles per hour, and the signs of the edge of the road showing distances to certain places are generally done in miles.
Whereas in Europe, certain Asian countries, Australia and New Zealand, the speedo in your car is shown in kilometers per hour, and the road signs are in kilometres to go.
So simple, eh? There's two different systems. But let's get back to the mile, as it has some interesting history. It seemed to stem from the Roman times, and I think the pronunciation is mil passus, which is, I think, is Roman for 1,000 paces. And this was derived from the left foot of a Roman soldier hitting the ground 1,000 times, so every other step. Of course, a well-fed army would make that Roman mile longer and vice versa.
There were also many other miles around, such as the Welsh mile, Saxon mile, German, Hungarian, Portuguese, Croatian, Ottoman, Russian, etc. The list goes on.
Yeah. But hey, good news, in 1959, some international consensus was reached, and the international mile was recognized as 1.609-something kilometers. So the countries recognizing this mile was the United States, United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa. But what about the humble kilometer, James?
In 1793, the French went about implementing the kilometer, as it's a much easier unit to deal with. So for the smaller units of measurements, it uses millimeters. So 100 millimeters equals 10 centimeters, 100 centimeters equals 1 meter, and 1,000 meters is a kilometer.
Okay, so basically two units for measuring distance or speed in the world. Easy so far. Why would it need to be complicated any further?
Enter the aviation model. So in aviation, for measuring speed, it would be logical to choose miles per hour or kilometers per hour. But that would be too simple. Instead, there is supposedly a logical reason for not picking either.
The unit of measurement is the nautical mile, and one nautical mile is equal to around 1.85 kilometers, or roughly 1.15 miles. So why the nautical mile? Well, it's all to do with the shape of the Earth. It's round, and for navigation, we split it up into degrees. So if you chopped our Earth in half and you saw it as a circle, and then divided the circle up into 360 segments, the distance between each segment where the Earth's surface would be 1/360. So that would be the equivalent of 60 nautical miles. And of course, a compass has 360 degrees.
But for navigation, this is where we come back to the base unit of nautical miles. I suppose you could have chopped it up like the metric system, but it would seem the degree system, thus nautical mile, came first and therefore it stuck.
Yeah, so distance and hence speed is measured in nautical miles in most countries. And this is where we'll demonstrate that ICAO wasn't able to manage to harmonize units of measurements in aviation. Because other countries, such as Russia, they use in the aircraft speed in kilometers per hour, and German World War II planes, they use kilometers per hour as well. So that's speed in our industry, a little bit of background there. And let's talk about wind velocity. Most of the world gives us the wind speed in knots, but Russia and China give it to us in meters per second. Hey, but not to be outdone, horizontal visibility in most places is measured in meters. But in America, this is measured in statute miles. Yeah, you heard that correct. Not nautical miles, but the miles that we talked about near the start of the episode that are longer than nautical miles, similar to the mile of unit being used for driving cars in America.
Following on, runway lengths in most countries are measured in meters. Over in the US, they're measured in feet.
Yeah, but luckily our charts on board have these lengths converted already for us into meters for the US.
Yeah, and you'd think that having an international civil aviation organization that have well been on their way to harmonizing this many years ago. However, they're dealing with a lot of countries that are already set in their own ways.
Yeah, so you can see the confusion that can occur. As of 2020, 188 out of 193 countries that are part of ICAO use feet instead of meters, with the major exceptions being Russia and China, meaning pilots must convert their instruments, which are in feet, and they must convert them into meters, as all the air traffic control clearances given to heights in these two countries are given to the pilots in meters. So this does add confusion and increases the workload of the pilot. And in recognition of this, some countries have adopted the more popular version. And in Russia in 2011, they did away with meters for aircraft at cruising altitude and went with the Western version of flight levels and feet. So good changes do sometimes occur. It's worth talking briefly here about the difference between altitude and flight levels. As an altimeter uses a pressure reference to measure its height above the ground, one must know the pressure at the ground or sea level above which the aircraft is flying, especially when taking off and coming into land, as this directly affects it keeping sufficiently clear of the local terrain. And this is commonly known as the altitude we are flying. However, whilst at the cruise altitude, the surface pressure at the ground is changing all the time as the aircraft crosses the planet. And you want all aircraft to be on the same pressure reference to each other so they maintain the same vertical separation from each other when they're flying really high. And hence, this is the term called flight level. And the level at which we transition from an altitude to a flight level varies with each country. And even sometimes within a country, there are variations to when it happens as well.
Luckily, everywhere in the world, the temperature for us in aviation is consistent. It is measured in degrees centigrade. Even in the US, where the non-aviation world expresses the temperatures in Fahrenheit.
Yeah, so we've just touched upon the chaos of aviation measuring units briefly here. And as you can see, ICAO, you might have thought, might have recommended, and they may have this be standardized many years ago, but every country has its own regulatory authority and some of them already set in their ways. So there wasn't really the ability to harmonize that, but things are changing slowly. Aeroplanes themselves are no different. Generally, the US manufacturers like Boeing, they use an imperial design and tooling on the aircraft, whilst the European Airbus can use a metric for design and their tooling as well. But now aircraft such as the Airbus 380, they have lots of different parts and there can be a mix of metric and imperial for the tooling on the aircraft. Some countries fill their planes up in litres and other countries in gallons, adds to a bit of confusion. And the gauges on the aircraft, they can be either in kilograms or pounds, depending on what the airline wanted the manufacturer to make as their preferred standard.
Luckily, incidents due to these confusing units of measurement are rare. However, issues have happened. Here is an example of where confusion could lead to chaos. In July 1983, a Boeing 767 was flying from Montreal to Edmonton and was about halfway into the flight when the engine stopped due to running out of fuel.
Yeah, but as per usual in aviation, it's not a simple case of the pilots not checking their fuel quantity and blatantly disregarding the most basic of aviation principles in that you should have enough fuel to complete the flight.
At the time, the Boeing 767 was fairly new, and they were having a lot of trouble with the fuel quantity indicator sensors, which are in the fuel tank. The backup system was misunderstood by the maintenance folk as well, and thus the fuel had to be manually measured with these things called dripsticks, which you access from under the wing. These are basically like a dipstick in reverse that you would otherwise put in the tank of fluid with measurements on the stick, and you can see how high the fuel is in the tank and thus calculate how much fuel is in the tank.
Yeah, so they take the measurement off the dripstick, and then the process called for the measurement to be converted from centimeters, that's the length on the dripstick, to liters, and then to kilograms. You see what's happening here? Confusion started already. But they did this calculation using the density figure from the airline's refueler receipt using pounds to liters, which was used for the other aircraft in their fleet, instead of kilograms to liters, which was metric for this new aircraft in their fleet. Basically, a pound is half a kilogram. So this error led to them misinterpreting their fuel load by about half the actual amount they needed, and off they went.
Good news of the story is that the pilots did a brilliant job at landing the aircraft with no power on a disused runway, and everyone on board had a great story to tell for the foreseeable future. Moving on, let's discuss NATTRACs.
Yeah, the NATTRACs, they are like a five-lane motorway or highway system linking North America to Europe. In pilot terms, we call this the OTS or the Organized Track System. And in 2012, there were approximately 460,000 flights that crossed the system.
As previously discussed, there is no radar or air traffic control surveillance over the oceans. Although with technology this is changing from a surveillance perspective, hence with lots of airplanes wanting to cross this area in the North Atlantic around the same period each day, they needed to come up with a system so aircraft wouldn't be getting too close to each other, thereby causing a huge amount of paperwork.
Yeah, so there are two peak flows every day. Aircraft departing Europe going to North America in the morning, so that's a westbound flow. Then aircraft departing North America in the evening and going the other way to Europe, so an eastbound flow.
These aircraft flying in one direction so close to each other, a cunning system needed to be implemented. As discussed earlier in our air traffic control episode, which is episode 28, there needs to be horizontal and vertical separation of aircraft and crews, well, for obvious reasons.
So there are generally five tracks all going the same way. They're spaced, they used to be spaced 60 miles apart, and they were given letters. So westbound tracks were given letters A, B, C, or track A, track B, track C, etc. Eastbound, it's backwards. It's the other way in the alphabet. So track Z, track Yankee, etc., etc. And the reason why they're giving letters is that each track, in essence, is a bunch of long-winded latitude and longitude coordinates, which would take ages to transmit on the radio to air traffic control Hence, a track letter which both the pilots and the air traffic control have all the coordinate data for. As a result, and to avoid confusion, there's also a track message indicator or a TMI for the day, as the tracks change coordinates every day. And this is a number taken from the Julian calendar day in the year. So the 4th of January would be track message indicator or TMI 004, and the 31st of December would be TMI 365.
As we said, these tracks are created on a daily basis, so now they're following the exact same route over the ocean each day. The primary reason is due to wind patterns and jet streams. The prevailing wind that is blowing from North America to Europe, so they tend to put the eastbound tracks from North America to Europe in the middle track, banging in the area of the strongest tailwind, hence ensuring the shortest flight times and therefore less fuel burn.
And obviously the wind changes each day, so they use the latest wind data in order to promulgate the tracks every day. Obviously, going from Europe to North America, they'll find the least amount of headwind and put the center track in that area.
So as a pilot, do you have to fly it on that track?
No, you don't have to. Airline flight planners can use a random route or even plan to cross NAT tracks, but there's likely to be limitations.
But all these aircraft flying close to each other in the same direction with 60 miles lateral separation and separated vertically by 1,000 feet.
Yep. And did you know the system was originally devised from a commercial shipping agreement way back in 1898? So ships actually followed a track system back then as well. The NAT track system was implemented in 1961.
Some interesting developments have taken place since the implementation of the track system, mainly born out of increased traffic and better monitoring technology, not only in the aircraft, but also for air traffic control.
Yeah, in 1981, the spacing between flights on the same track letter and at the same altitude was reduced to a minimum of 10 minutes separation. So a plane in front of you at the same level had to be 10 minutes flying away, minimum.
And in 1996, GPS was approved. They then reduced vertical separation in 1997. In 2006, they went from a scratchy high-frequency radio to CPDLC, which is like text messaging for communicating between air traffic control and aircraft.
Yep. And then in 2015, they reduced that lateral separation from 60 down to 30 miles. Of course, space-based monitoring of aircraft through satellites was implemented in March of 2019, which meant better monitoring by air traffic control, which in turn meant aircraft could fly at their more optimum speed and levels.
In November 2020, the NAT system, with its efficiency, reckon they saved 400 to 650 kilos, or 880 to 1,430 pounds of fuel per flight crossing.
Yeah, interesting.
And, well, talking about fuel, what about the Concorde when it used to fly the route between London and New York?
Yeah, it used to fly above the NAT tracks at altitudes between 45 to 60,000 feet or 14 to 18 kilometres. Because the weather patterns at these altitudes changed very little each day, the Concorde flew the same track letter each day and it had its own track letters, track Sierra Mike going westbound and track Sierra November going the other way. So enough of tracks. Let's talk about runways. Why do runways face the way they do, James?
Yeah, so planes need to take off and land into the wind. This is to increase the amount of air going over the wings, generating lift, and therefore this makes them use less tarmac to take off and land. Most places on Earth generally have like a general wind direction. For example, here in New Zealand, the general wind direction is either a northeasterly or southwesterly. Auckland International Airport, therefore, has its runways accordingly built to that, runway 23 and 05. However, space can also be a limitation. In Wellington and New Zealand, they could only build a runway facing north-south, even though, as I mentioned just before, the general wind direction is a northeasterly, southwesterly flow. This means crosswinds often play a factor in takeoff and landing, which has in past created media sensationalism. Regardless of the fact that pilots are trained to fly and land in extremely windy conditions, albeit not that smooth. Just ask Grant about his last landing.
Oh, that's a bit harsh, James, but harsh.
Moving on from talking about Grant's dodgy landings, wingspan and weight are the next thoughts that are put into airports. Say you have an aircraft with a 50-meter wingspan. If it's on the center line, it's going to go 25 meters over both sides from that center line. This means you're going to need a taxiway that has its center line over 50 meters apart for two aircraft with 50 meter wingspan to pass. Now take into account aircraft such as the A380 with an 80 meter wingspan, and then the fact that the different separations needed between runways, taxiways, and stands. It all becomes very confusing very quickly. These limitations are just one part of why an airline doesn't just bring a larger aircraft into an airport if flights are full. Following on, for example, let's again look at the A380, which requires stronger runways and taxiways, which could actually take the weight of the A380. It then needs special jetways to reach the upper deck, special catering vehicles to reach the upper deck, etc., etc. And all of a sudden, what may seem super simple actually requires significant investment on the airlines and airports' behalf just to get an aircraft of the size of the A380 in it. All these factors are why the A380 can only land at a small number of airports and is actually quite a tricky aircraft to operate.
Yeah, it's interesting. Anyway, this concludes this episode, and we've covered the difference between IAKO, which is like a regulatory organization, as opposed to IATA, which is an organization run by aviation companies. We then discussed the crazy variety of units used in aviation throughout the world. I had a chat about the motorway system across the North Atlantic and finished with you talking about airport design.
You had the next episode is episode 40, which was going to be the last in the series. We're going to chat about some of the highlights of the series, some of the points obviously you guys as listeners have enjoyed listening to, some of the statistics from downloads, which is quite interesting because it really gives a good idea as to what people are actually sort of afraid of when it comes to flying, and what we sort of plan on doing going forward with Fearless Flyer, discussing future series. Yeah.
Sounds good. Okay, well, from me, thank you very much to your ears for listening, and from James,
have a good day wherever you are in the world, and we'll speak to you again soon.